Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so welcome everyone. It is 22nd of Adar, March 20th, 2017. I just checked, and this is the hundred and actually, let me be exact here. Yes, this is the 172nd class I have done. So that's a lot of classes, and it's a lot of time. Those who've been with me for a number of years probably have seen the difference that the earlier classes, I wanted to cover everything in two or three classes. So believe it or not, I did Rav Israel Hildesheimer in two classes, Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg in two, Rav Cook in three. But I really wanted to cut it into shorter segments. As time went on, I figured that doesn't make any sense. So now I go as long as it takes. So six classes on Rav Yisrael Meltzer, eight classes on, I think it was eight classes on Rav Yitzchak Elchanan or the Chasam Sofer, and it'll probably be five or six classes on Rabbi Charlap, but I think that's okay. I don't have a schedule I have to end by, and I feel better doing it, as long as I feel it takes to give a complete treatment. And maybe I'll go back to some of the earlier classes. Because I mean, think of some of those people, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, the Sri Deish, they definitely deserve more than two classes. Well, let us pick up. I want before we continue more again in the biography, I want to call your attention to a few things. Before I do, I was asked at the end of class by someone about sources for the relationship of the Brisker Rav and Rav Charlap. I have it here, and I said he sent people to Rav Charlap for brachas if they were ill. It's not. I see. It's not just Rav Charlap. He also sent to Rabbi Aryeh Levine, which both of these people were in the camp of Rav Cook. And knowing how much the Brisker Rav opposed the philosophy of Rav Cook, that's quite significant. But I actually found in this book I mentioned at the end of last class. About Rav Shach, how surprised he was that the Brisker Rav, who was so opposed to the philosophy of Rav Cook, nevertheless, personally, when he wrote to him, was very respectful. This book I have here, I mentioned last class, it's Maamar Rome is the it's a collection of writings of Rav Charlap, about 18, I think it's 18 volumes. And volume 17 only appeared in 2012. And I don't know what they didn't include, what was censored. I can say that what they did include, and look how thick a book is, this is a spiritual diary, I guess you can call it. If you know Rav Kook Shmona Kvatzim, his Orot, this is very similar in that it's short segments of maybe 10 lines each. In which Rav Charlap expresses theological ideas that came to him without any rhyme or reason, not any order. They just flow, much like with Rav Kook. If you read it, each paragraph says something else, and it's organic, it's natural, it's not put together as a thought to put an article or a book or anything like that. These are just the thoughts that. Now, what they did here, however, is they put them into categories. But there's a couple, since we spoke last class about his defense of Rav Kook, let me read to you or summarize for you what he says on page 225 and 226. Now, the editors don't mention what this refers to, but if you read it, it's obvious it's referring to the opponents of Rav Kook. It's called, the first one deals with the secret understanding of why Torah scholars. Dispute. Anyone who was living at that time during the dispute over Rav Kook would have to be concerned about that because it wasn't just the crazy little fanatics. There were Torah scholars who were opposed as well. And Rav Charlap, this on page 225, explains that there are some tzaddikim who their greatness comes to them from nature, and they're always up in the stratosphere, the spiritual stratosphere. And because of that, they haven't been able to perfect the smaller aspects of their personality, that is, those aspects that deal with the everyday, the here and now. And he says that these people, if they were by themselves and they didn't have a role of leadership, hanhaga, then they wouldn't have to perfect these smaller elements, you know, the everyday things. Because they would always be, as he says, behechale hagadlut. They would always be focused on spiritual things. But because they have upon them the yoke of the tzibur, of the community, therefore, this isn't good enough. And they have a difficult problem because they don't know to how to deal with the little things. I think here's an allusion to the opponents of Rav Kook, who don't know how to deal with, you know, the regular people, the irreligious people, the everyday matters of normal people. He doesn't say that explicitly. You know, soon I'll read you things where it's pretty explicit, without mentioning my name, but pretty explicit who he's referring to. But I think here is a good insight, and I think we can all agree that we've come across people like that who maybe are very pious and spiritual, but can't live in the world. They don't live in the their Luftmenschen. They don't live properly with other people, and that would be fine if they could just live in their holy spiritual world. But Rav Charlap says the problem is when these people have to be down in the here and now. And at the end of the day, real leaders do have to live in the here and now. And if you have a leader who's only in the spiritual realm and doesn't know how to live in the here and well, he's not going to be a good spiritual leader. Next page, 226. It's titled Limud Zchut, Finding Justification or Defense of Anashim Gedolim Shenichshelu, great people who have, I don't know if here it means sin so much as stumbled. And he says that when you try to find defense for great people, it isn't just to defend their actions, but we have to understand why it is that they fell. And he explains again, because they are not of this world. Sometimes these great sages, they're real, and he gives an example. He says, if you come to a new land and you don't know anything about the new land, its customs, its practices, you'll make all sorts of mistakes. And it's the same thing. He says, that's the limud zchut. That's how we can try to at least give some justification for these great spiritual people who make mistakes and really mess up. It's because they're not part of our world. They're only in the spiritual world. But as we've already seen, that's a problem because then they're not supposed to be leaders. But he's trying to be Melamed Zchut and trying to say that we see these spiritual people who really make terrible blunders. That's because they're not really of this world. They're really of a different world, and they're forced to be in this world. So it's not surprising that sometimes they make mistakes. It's clear you can understand this as referring to the opponents of Rav Kook. The opponents of Rav Kook are really not, they're not really focusing on the here and now. They don't know how to deal in the here and now, and therefore they misjudge everything. So we're trying to be Melamed Zchut, as we say, on great people. We spoke a lot last class, you know, about how Rav Charlap defended Rav Kook and the relationship, and everyone says that Rav Charlap is a student or a, they don't know what to say, he's a student. They say he's a Talmid Chaver, student colleague, which he was. But Rav Charlap himself was embarrassed by that characterization and didn't like it at all. We have a little book here, published in 1953. Get it for you here. Called, there's a new edition too, Heid Harim, which are letters of Rav Charlap to Rav Kook. They needed letters because before Rav Kook moved to Jerusalem, and then when he was away twice, when he left the diaspora, went to the diaspora, he was away for a long time, so they couldn't communicate in person as they saw each other every day. They communicated through letters. So a lot of very interesting stuff. And in one of them, he writes to Rav Kook that he suffered a lot, and by seeing a description of him, gave him all these highfalutin titles. And then he says, also, when they described me as a Talmud Chaver for you, Rav Kook, as a student colleague, because as he says, I'm not a student colleague. First of all, forget being a colleague. He says, this Siarti Harbe, it caused me a great deal of pain. He says, even though most of my thoughts in Torah come from you, I've never regarded myself as your student, because I know how great you are, he says. I am not worthy of being called your student, and all the more so being called a Talmid Chaver, a student colleague, which he says brings people, you know, to laughter. And then he says, I was going to protest it, but I figured it's better not to say anything. That'll be more productive. So again, we see how much he was, we don't have an English word for this, but in Hebrew, the word is to be mevatel. He was mevatel himself entirely to Rav Kook. And as I said, for Rav Charlap, Rav Kook is the tzaddik, the special tzaddik. We'll see some examples of this soon. Sent to guide the generation. He can't be, he's a Kohen, so he can't be the Mashiach, but he's the one that's going to guide us to the Messianic era. Let me read you something else here from Heit Harim. This is from the new edition, 74-75. Just to give you a sense of the connection. He writes to him in, when Rav Kook is in Chutz Aretz. He says that in 1916, Rav Kook is now in Switzerland, or maybe now in England. He says, I'm writing to you to tell you what happened. I had a vision, he says, at the Kotel. What was the vision? That the vision said to me as follows. I have to write to Rav Kook because he's now in Chutz Aretz. And Rav Kook, this is the vision is saying this to Rav Charlap, is connected to you nefesh b'nefesh, that, you know, your souls are connected. And you have to write to Rav Kook that he should pray for you. So Rav Charlap is writing to Rav Kook that in the vision I saw that I should write to you, that you have to pray a lot for me to lahalotcha l'madrigat ruach hakodesh, so that you, Rav Kook, through your prayers, can bring me, Rav Charlap, to the level of ruach hakodesh, as Rav Charlap is attempting to reach ruach hakodesh. And then it says, if both of you together would raise oneself, and no, I'm sorry, as Rav Kook is attempting to raise himself up to ruach hakodesh, and if you both together would raise yourself, then that will accomplish great things. And then he continues, if you were here, Rav Kook, together with us in Jerusalem, again, we could reach unbelievable heights. And he goes on like this. I mean, this is not typical things that one rabbi or a student writes to another about heavenly visions. And yet, how does Rav Kook write to Rav Charlap? Let me just read you one letter. And he writes this sort of thing numerous places. I found this. I just looked for it in volume 2, number 416 of the letters of Rav Kook. He writes to Rav Kook as follows. I mean, Rav Charlap as follows. After the letter, Mechabko umenashko. I hug you and I kiss you. Beruach neshikah shel krivutat. With the spirit of kissing, of, you know, ideas coming together. Shel gedua v'tzafiyat Yeshua. I don't know how you translate all this. But Rav Kook is expressing the same sort of emotion and how difficult it is to be apart from Rav Charlap. A few other things I think are of interest in the Heit Harim. Now it's the old edition. I'm looking at page 51 from 1913. Rav Kook is in Yafo, Rav Charlap's in Jerusalem. That's why they write to each other. And he says, I just received a telegram that the Ridbaz, Rav Yaakov Dobrovolovsky, is very ill. And posters went up about this. And he says, Ra'oi Shagam Maran Admor Shlita. He says, also you, he calls him Admor and Maran, you should pray for him. The Yislach Lo Kol Asher Chatan Negdo, Yimcha Li Aldvari Melo. He says, and you, Rav Kook, should forgive the Ridbaz for all the bad things, all the way he sinned against you, and forgive me for suggesting this. The Ridbaz, towards the end, he said terrible things about Rav Kook, and did not treat him with a good deal of respect. So now that he's deathly ill, and he dies, this is the illness of which he dies from, Rav Charlap asks Rav Kook, with all due respect, see, find it within yourself to forgive him. Maybe that would be a limud zchus in heaven, for Rav Charlap. On page 53, we have interesting information. also from 1914 here, that he says that he met Rabbi Sonnenfeld, and Rav Sonnen, and already at this time, the crazies were attacking Rav Kook, and he says that Rav Sonnenfeld told him that he protested against these crazies, and he wants Rav Kook to know that don't you know, although people are spreading the word that Rav Sonnenfeld is opposed to him, it's not true. I think that's what he means by saying there, Rav Kook should know that unlike the cry that's coming, no, sorry, that he was, don't assume that he wasn't involved, that he was there and he protested. That's what I think it means. Then, on page 86, this is from 1921. What does he write to him? Rav Charlap writes to Rav Kook about a dream he had. Again, like a vision, a dream. And what's in the dream? He says a number of things, but what's interesting to me is that he says that one of the people who came to him in a dream was the rabbi of Brisk. That's Rabbi Yeshua Diskin, who comes to Israel, was the rabbi there with Rav Salant, and his son, Rabbi Yitzchak Rucham Diskin, was one of the extremists, one of the opponents of Rav Kook. So in this dream, and Rav Charlap was close to both of them. Was he close? Well, he was close to Yitzchak Yerucham. I forget what day the Brisker Rav died. Whether he, I'll tell you in a second here. That's Yehoshua Leib Diskin, who himself was a bit of an extremist. But 1898. So Rav Charlap, of course, knew him. And in the dream, Rav Diskin says to Rav Charlap to tell Rav Kook, please don't be angry at my son Yitzchak Yeruchim, because he's my only son. And yes, he made a mistake, but he did it without knowing. And Rav Kook should remember that, this the institute, the Diskin Orphanage, which I founded, you should work for that. That's an important point, because the crazies who opposed Rav Kook were associated with the Diskin Orphanage. They were involved with it, and they used that as like their cover. So he's saying that Rav Kook should not turn away from the orphanage. Finally, one more thing from Heit Harim, page 80. This I find incredible as well. Rav Charlap asks him. This is he write the letter is dated. Let's see the year. It's 1918. It's still or 1919. It's still when no 1918. It's when Rav Kook is still in England. What does he ask him? Im nitztayera tmunato hakdosha na l'shalcheini. If a picture, if there's a picture of you. If someone drew a picture, there was actually a picture made of him, a famous picture in London. It's one of the most famous pictures of Rav Kook. It's a drawing, not a photograph. But he's asking for a photograph of Rav Kook to be sent to him. He wants to see that. He wants to have that in front of him. If you know about the relationship between Hasidim and Rebbes, that's a big deal. The image of not Hasidim, I'd even think it's a bit idolatrous, but in some Hasidic circles, you're supposed to, imagine the picture of the Rebbe. It brings you to holiness, things like that. And that's part of the connection that people have to the Rebbe. And Rav Charlap asks that to be sent to him. This is actually dealt with in this book, Smadar Shurlo. I don't know. I see Rabbi Kelman is with us. I'm assuming Yuval Shurlo was in Toronto, a Torah in Motion. I don't know if his wife has ever spoken, but his wife is Smadar Shurlo, and she's a scholar as well and has written. Rabbi Shurlo was a scholar and a rabbi. What I mean is that he writes scholarly books in addition to being a rabbinic figure. His wife is just the scholarship. She has a big, thick book, as you can see here, how big it is, on called Tzadik Yesod Olam, and it deals with. Does it have an English title page? Let me see. Yes, Rav Kook's Esoteric Mission and the Mystical Experience. So it's all about Rav Kook, how he views the role of the tzaddik. And in the middle there, she deals with Rav Charap and Rav Charap's relationship. In fact, it discusses the correspondence they had during World War I when Rav Charap became very messianic and really thought that the redemption is going to come, as, you know, in a miraculous way. And Rav Charap is told by Rav Kook, no, we still follow the path that's, you know, we see, that Rav Kook sees of Kima, that, you know, a little bit, that it's going to come through natural means and come a tiny bit. And he disabuses Rav Charap of the expectation that there's going to be some miraculous redemption. As I said, Rav Charap is completely mevatel himself to Rav Kook. A couple of years ago, this came out, Or Chadash, which Gilyon Yuchad, 60 years since the death of Hagon HaTzadik, they call him, which is how he's known as Rav Charap. Listen to this from page 36. These are the sorts of stories that you hear about the Briskers. And it's like you're taking fine, wow. I mean, the stories you read about the Briskers and how, you know, Rav Elul and Rav Chaim and their students, you feel like you can't get them anywhere else. But listen to this story. It's something that you'd hear almost from the Briskers. This comes from Yosef Shmuel Brandwein, who is known as the Admor of Starten. That's an important family from the Kabbalistic yeshiva in Jerusalem, Shara Shamayim, as I recall. He tells the following story, that in 1919, when Rav Kook returned to Jerusalem, there was a Kabbalist panim for him, and you know, everyone was there from all the yeshiva circles. And when when he came to his home, there was a huge crowd, and it was very, you know, very tight inside Rav Kook's house. And there was a sofa there, and who was on this? And Aleha Shachav Moriva Rabbi Agon Yakimo Shacharap. Rav Charap was laying on the couch, and the house is packed. I went to Rav Kook's house, by the way, last summer. I highly recommend it. And the house is packed. So he says that I got up the courage and I asked Rav Charap, here, you know, there's no room for anyone. There's no room to sit down or to stand. And Rav Charap is laying on the couch. You know, the two or three other people could sit on the couch. So I asked Rav Charap, maybe he could move a little bit so I could sit on the couch. And there are other people, he says, Lodon Hashim Zakain. No, actually not himself. Perhaps instead of laying down, Rav Charap could sit up on the couch, and therefore there'd be room for some old people. And what did Rav Charap say? Harav Amarli, the rabbi said, that's Rav Kook said, I should sit down and rest on the sofa. And how do you rest on the sofa? You know, I should rest on the sofa. And therefore, in every second, I'm being mekayim the mitzvah of listening to the Rebbe. And that's very important. How can I stop and sit up? Move if the Rebbe told me to rest. So what happened, no doubt, was Rav Charap was there before the other people were there. Rav Kook said to rest, so he lays down on the couch to rest. And now the place is packed and full of people. He's not going to get up, though, because Rav Kook told him to rest. And he has to continue to rest. So, I mean, what a story. I know some of you are probably thinking this is crazy, but if you know these spiritual personalities, they live in a sort of different world than ours. Rav Kook comes back from England in 1919 when that story took place. And a few years later, in 1924, Rav Kook decides, he decided before 1924, but it only comes to fruition in 24, that they need to have a new yeshiva. A yeshiva, there weren't many yeshivas in the land of Israel in those days. Hebron hasn't come yet, and you have the Etz Chaim yeshiva, but he wants a classic, like, Lithuanian-type yeshiva of older bacharim and with shiurim, not just where everyone does their own thing. And he also wants a broader type of yeshiva. We have letters of Rav Kook where he discusses, you know, what type of curriculum, but he wants to include emunah, machshava, that sort of thing, and have a Zionist flavor to it. And the yeshiva opens in 1924. It's called the Yeshiva HaMerkazit, the Central Yeshiva. It's supposed to be the Central Yeshiva in Israel. We know it today as Merkaz HaRav, but it was never called Merkaz HaRav. I shouldn't say that. It might have been called in his lifetime. I'm not aware, but it was not officially ever called, and to this day, it's not officially called. It's Yeshiva HaMerkazit. It actually, let me. I believe it. I think the official title is Yeshiva HaMerkazit. Yeah, Merkazit Olamit. That is the world central yeshiva. So it's not just in Israel; it's for the entire world. And not unexpected, Rav Charlap, although he's also the rabbi of Shaarei Chesed, is appointed rabbi or one of the ramim, one of the teachers at this yeshiva. And he's there, and when until the end of his life, when Rav Kook dies in 1935, he becomes Rosh Yeshiva. He remains Rosh Yeshiva until his death. Furthermore, in 1945, he establishes another yeshiva called Beit Zvul, which is also the name I mentioned already of his work of responsa. It's named after his father, Zvulun. Merkaz was for unmarried students. They didn't have married students then. Married, you'd have to go off to a kollel or do something. So Beit Zvul was for married students, and the yeshiva exists to this day. The students who go there dress very Haredi, but I'm told that they have Rav Charlap's philosophy. They dress Yerushalmi, as it were. One the Roshi, although he was the head Roshi, although he was the official Rosh Yeshiva, those who were acting as Rosh Yeshiva and gave shiurim were his sons-in-law. He had a number of very learned sons-in-law. One of the people who weren't there's a number of people who weren't there, but one of the people who weren't there, I'll mention him because his approach has become popular in recent years, was Rav Yitzchak Shlomo Zilberman. Rav Yitzchak Shlomo Zilberman is known today because there's something called the Zilberman method. According to the Wikipedia entry on him, he actually had 18 children. He died in 2001. He created this method, or I shouldn't say created it. He started a school, and then that became more schools, and now it's somewhat popular in the religious Zionist world, and there's a couple in the Haredi world as well. We're going back to the old Mishnaic curriculum. First of all, they have class every day of the week. They even, I mean, they have learning and programming every day of the week. But what is it, this Zilberman method? We all know that in Pirkei Avot, it gives you from age 5, age 10, age 15. No one's supposed to start Talmud at age 15. No one follows that approach. But that's where Zilberman did. First, they learn all of Nach, and then they do all of Mishnah, and they know much of it by heart, and only then do they start Talmud. I don't know whether they wait till 15 or whether earlier, but they until they know all of Tanakh and all of Mishnah, that's when they do it. I believe they even have class. They have to go to the yeshiva, which is in their neighborhood, even on Shabbat, I think, in the afternoon for learning and. So it's their own sort of approach. I'm surprised it hasn't been more controversial in the Haredi world, but I guess because it hasn't really taken off. But that's Rav Zilberman. Rav Kook passes away. And by the way, it might be a good method. I mean, it's hard to start a new method, but it has, if you're in Israel, you can send your kids to the Zilberman school. I don't know why you would want to send your kids. In what way is this a better approach than the old approach of starting kids earlier? I mean, I'm not sure if you're going to say some young kids don't want to learn Gemara. So fine, so they don't need to learn Gemara. We can have a different system where they don't learn Gemara. But I don't know why, if no one really has adopted that approach in hundreds of years, and even the Maharal, no one adopted his approach as far as I know. What was wrong with the old way? It seemed, if you're in the Haredi world, it seemed to produce a lot of scholars and sages. But that's the Zilberman approach. In 1935, Rav Kook passes away. And who's going to be his successor? For many, especially many people in the old Yishuv, what they called the old Yishuv is the people who had been here for since the 19th century, early 20th century, the traditional Jews, not the new Olim, actually before, you talk about the 19th century, before the beginning of the Great Aliyah, there was a strong feeling that Rav Harlap has to be the successor as chief rabbi. Rav Maimon, Yehudalev Fishman, he changed his name to Maimon. He was a leading follower of Rav Kook. He also thought, and he was an important figure in the Mizrahi movement, a very important figure in the early state of Israel. He signed the Declaration of Independence. He and a number of others thought that Rav Charlap, as the Talmid Muvhak of Rav Kook and the one who carried on this religious Zionist approach, he has to be the successor to Rav Kook, and it doesn't. There's no one else even to fit the foot the bill. And if you're looking in the land of Israel, that is true. There wasn't anyone in the land of Israel who really was there then who could be the chief rabbi. You could say Rav Aaronson from Tel Aviv, but there really wasn't a Ratzi Pesach Frank, perhaps. Yeah, I guess Ratzi Pesach Frank maybe, but it was natural for Rav Charlap. However, by 1935, Jerusalem and the state of Israel, and not state of Israel, but the land of Israel, is not just the old Yishuv. It isn't the old communities. You have now a fairly large community of people who came over from Europe in the last 20 years, last 30 years. You have German Orthodox Jews, you have Jews from Poland, you have all sorts. You have the Hebron Yeshiva there now, you have in Tel Aviv, you have a whole community of Orthodox Jews in Tel Aviv. And their approach was that we don't need to pick someone from the land of Israel. We need to pick the best qualified person. In those days, to be the chief rabbi, you had to be a Zionist. So, who was the other person who was drafted, as it were? That's Rabbi Herzog, who at this time, Yitzhak Isaac Levi Herzog, is living in Ireland, in Dublin, in a small little community. You know, they call Chief Rabbi of Ireland, but he's the only rabbi in Ireland, although Ireland always had great chief rabbis. This is clearly going to be a huge step up. He had been a candidate for the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv a few years before, the same one that Rav Soloveitchik was the candidate for, and he didn't get that. So now is the chance. And so the dispute breaks out then. Is it going to be Chief Rabbi Herzog, who's a recognized Talmudic scholar, as is Rav Charlap, but Rav Herzog also has a PhD. He speaks many languages, English, French, German. He's very wide-ranging in secular studies, versus Rav Charlap, who's never left the land of Israel, who's very spiritual, Kabbalistically inclined. So who's it going to be? We have a book that was published also not long ago, if I have it here. A small book. It's called Michtavei Marom. Michtavei Marom are letters of Rav Charlap to his son, Rav Yechiel Michal Charlap. That's the father of Zvulun Charlap of YU. As many others, he comes to America to make a living, and it's not like today where you can go back and forth and Skype and all that. They communicate through letters. So this whole book, not a very large book, but over 100 pages of the letters that Rav Charlap sends to reporting on everything going on in Jerusalem. Again, I'd like to know what they didn't include in that. I'm sure there's lots of good stuff. But he discusses the fact that he's chosen to be, to put his hat in the ring as chief rabbi. And you see how uncomfortable he was with that. You know, who am I? He says, but they've asked me to be the chief rabbi, and if they've asked me to do it, it must be God's will. And so he allows himself to be put forward. Furthermore, a whole volume was published, a biography of him by his supporters. And this is all part of the propaganda to try to encourage people to vote for him. And the stress is always on the fact that he's the successor to Rav Kook. If that was all it was, you'd say fine. But in addition to that, Don't think that the Pashkevillim, as they call them, and that the negative advertising is only something found in the Haredi world and in the extremist world. At least in those days, it existed in the other world as well, because attacks started being raised against Rav Herzog. Letters started being sent out that you're going to bring in a rabbi doctor to Jerusalem that's going to destroy Jerusalem. Rav Herzog is in line, league with the modernists, the reformers. He doesn't value Torah. He's a doctor. All these sorts of things. So that then led to Rav Herzog supporters to launch a counteroffensive. The counteroffensive even leads to Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski to write a letter, which is then made public, saying he has nothing against Rav Herzog, who he knows is a great scholar. In the archive of Rav Herzog, which I examined this archive years ago in Heichal Shlomo, subsequently it's been removed from Heichal Shlomo and is now in the Israel State Archives. The great thing about the Israel State Archives, you can go online and see it, is that they have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of documents. And you can Google, and you can put in a name, and then it pops up, and it shows you all the different files. Now, all these files, you click on them, there's a multi-year program now to take all these files and put them online. But this is going to take years and years. So if I'm doing research, let's say, on Rav Herzog, and I go there, and they have all Rav Herzog papers, and you click on it, and it's not online, and it says, it's in the midst of it, then you'd be like, well, you're stuck. You might not be online for 10 years. And don't say you can go to Jerusalem and see it, because I tried it. Some of the papers you can, but others that are in the process of being put online, it could be 6 months, a year before they get to it, and you can't access it till then. However, they did something amazing. All you need to do is fill out a little form online that takes 15 seconds. You get an email back saying that, thank you for doing that. They will get to work. In other words, they have hundreds of thousands of pages. They're just going random, whatever is in front of them. If you send in a request, they will take out what you request and they'll put that at the top. They don't, what do they care? If someone's requesting it, they might as put it at the top. Otherwise, it could take 10 years to get to that. So I requested about 40 files from Rav Herzog over the last few weeks, and on average, it took about 1 or 2 weeks before the files came online. And now they're online, and anyone can see them. Anyone going today to the Israel State Archives will have access to them, no problem. And that's all because of me. I put them on, and I found all sorts of great stuff. And in one of the files, and it doesn't say it, I had to go through the files because the name of this file was simply, oh no, sorry, this file is one of the ones you could see. It's appointment of Chief Herzog as Chief Rabbi. Some of the other files just say, correspondence and things like that, but I found all sorts of good stuff in it. So if you look in this file, there's a publication which is obviously designed to be sent out to all over the world, and it's a number of pages, Mipitkamei Gdolei Hador Al HaGaon Rav Yitzchak Levi Herzog, including things said by the great rabbis about Rav Herzog. So the first page, they quote Rav Zalman Meltzer, that he's a Gaon Atzum, and he should be the one, Rak Lo, just him is the one that should be chief rabbi. And many other great rabbis are quoted as support of his, positive things about him from the Chazon Ish. Then they even have a whole page from Rabbi Yecheskel Sarna, the Chevron Yeshiva, in which he says that, in my opinion, that Zechut Gedola Hi L'mi Shevyado Yisrael B'Davar V'Zakot Eretz. He says, in my opinion, it's a great Zechut, whoever can ensure that Rav Herzog is chosen as chief rabbi. Then a similar letter from Rav Yitzhak Scher of the Slobodka Yeshiva in Slobodka. He even calls him Rabbi Doctor. And then a letter from Rav Reuven Katz of Petach Tikva, quoting the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish says that Rav Herzog is the one who's suitable for this position. So that's important backing. What's it going to be? What's going to happen? An important development was shortly before the election of the chief rabbinate, which was politicians voted, some religious figures, same as today, Rav Tukachinsky, who's a member of the old Yishuv from one of the directors of the yeshiva, the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. He comes out with a public statement. Let me read it to you. And that really showed that his position, by the way, he served as the he was the Rosh Yeshiva of he was married to the granddaughter of Shmuel Salant, and for a time he was the Rosh Yeshiva, and then they brought in I don't know if he was official Rosh Yeshiva, but then they brought in as we know, Rishon Zalman Meltzer, who had a more of an international reputation. Okay, let me read you what Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky says. I just want to say he's born in Lithuania, but he comes early on to the land of Israel, yeah, in 1882. So he's a member of the old Yeshuv. So you'd expect Rav Tukhachinsky to be backing Rav Charlotte. No. If Shmuel Avidor HaKohen, that's the brother of Pinchas Pelli, has a biography in Rav Herzog, and he quotes Tukhachinsky's public letter. He says, "Many people have asked me which of the two candidates I support." And he says, "I have to tell you that even though I have great friendship with the Mu'amad HaYerushalmi, with the Jerusalem candidate, namely Rav Charlotte, I have to say that despite the fact that I love and respect him, and even though especially I love Tzeret Ha'aretz, the product of the land, that he's from the land of Israel, Ohev ani yoter tovat ha'aretz. I love even more the good of the land." In other words, even though I love Rav Charlap, I love Eretz Yisrael and what's going to be for Eretz Yisrael even more. In other words, I have to do what's best for Eretz Yisrael. And he says this requires all of us, kulanu, to support Rabbi Herzog. And he says why? Because the chief rabbinate doesn't just need a gaon and a tzaddik; it also needs a special sort of person. And that, just like we had in Rav Cook, he says, we can also see it in Rav Herzog. We need an ishiyut bilti mitzuyah. When you see these words and you think of what the chief rabbinate became in the state of Israel, you have to wonder. But Rav Tukhachinsky saw in 1935 very clearly what was happening. It was only a matter of time before there was a state of Israel. There was all sorts. You needed someone in a position who was going to be able to deal with the British, was going to be able to travel the world and speak to religious Jews all over the world, who's going to be able to help craft a religious state. That means someone, remember, of Herzog, who's an expert in law and all this, you need someone who's going to be able to speak to the doctors and the lawyers and the politicians and be able to work on writing a constitution and to be able to solve all the problems you need, all the sorts of things that are coming. Tukhachinsky had no idea, obviously, about the coming Holocaust. The fact that Rav Herzog, what he did during the Holocaust to rescue all that, just adds to his vision. Rav Tukhachinsky saw the Rav Charlap, who's a holy man, but a man who's never left this Eretz Yisrael, who has no secular education, whose entire world is in the Torah books, who really doesn't understand the outside world and can't relate in the same sophisticated fashion that Rav Herzog would show so wonderfully how he was able to be a leader, not just from a perspective of Psak and Halakha, things like that, but in all areas. He dealt with all the scientific problems and everything. Rav Tukhachinsky was right on that to be chief rabbi of the modern, Palestine, State of Israel, Eretz Israel, you need someone who's aware of the modern world and can deal with it productively. And Rav Tukhachinsky said that as someone who has no involvement in the modern world, has no secular education. His whole life had been spent in the old yeshuv, and yet he was smart enough to realize that rabbis like him were not what was needed in 1935 in Eretz Yisrael. It's not 1835, it's 1935 with the British mandate. And remember, the chief rabbinate is a government-appointed position. Rav Charlap didn't speak English. How is he supposed to deal with the High Commissioner? All these things, and that's what really turned the tide. And in the final vote, Rav Herzog received 37 votes, and Rav Charlap 31 votes. So he would not have an official position, but he remains, of course, an important personality. Shortly after that, there's the Peel Commission meets. That's the British Commission to decide what to do with the land of Israel. There already had been battles between the Jews and the Arabs. This is before any Irgun or Stern Group attacks on the British. But the British were looking into the future, and it was clear that the colonialism would come to an end sooner or later. So the Peel Commission met, and they recommended partition to divide it into, if you look at the history of the various partitions, the Arabs are just so stupid. Abba Ibn once famously said that the Arabs never failed. What did he say? Never failed to miss an opportunity. Never failed to fail to miss an opportunity. Or something like that. I forget the exact wording. It was much better than I just said it. Basically, he said they never failed to miss an opportunity. It wasn't fail. Yeah, maybe it was never failed to fail to miss an opportunity. If they had taken any of these partitions, the earlier partition, the 1947, anything, they would have much more than they'll ever get, if they ever get anything. But they kept voting against their own interests, it seems. So what to do? We discussed this already in the Rav Herzog classes and Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski classes, because Rav Herzog didn't know what to do. On the one hand, here you have an opportunity to, they thought maybe this would a state would be coming quickly, and that expressed hopes in favor of a partition. Obviously, if the Arabs and the Jews each say that we don't want a partition, Britain will be happy to stay there. But the question is, can you agree to a partition? Because then you're giving up parts of the biblical land of Israel. And how can you do that? That would perhaps be forbidden. Although Rav Chaim Moser, as he said, and Rav Herzog wasn't sure, but Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski said, we're not giving anything up. They're not offering us everything. So if this is all they're offering, then this is what we could take. But not everyone had that perspective. And Rav Charlap, he opposed agreeing to any partition, because that would formalize our acceptance of giving up land. If he said, if the British will give us a piece of land, we're not going to say no because we want everything, but we will not agree formally to say that we agree to take this and give up our rights to that, because that's denying our Torah heritage. Whereas Rav Chaim Moser thought, this isn't denying your Torah heritage. You just they're not giving you everything. So to get the little bit, you say, okay, for we give we're not we accept this. It doesn't mean that we give up the other thing. One day we might get it again, like in 67 or the Messianic era. But Rav Charlap said, absolutely not. In the book Shirat Hayam, which is the book of stories of Rav Charlap, it has his statement about this. And he says that Hadavar Barur Pasha Techalila LeYisrael Avater. God forbid, we can't give up anything. And he says, if it comes to that we have to sign such a document, it's better to cut off our hands than sign a document. Just as we say the whole Torah is from heaven, with the exception, but if you say the whole Torah is from heaven except for one letter, you're a heretic. So too, if you say that all of Israel, Eretz Israel, belongs to Israel with the exception of one footstep's worth, you are removing part of Eretz Israel. It's hard to see, though, how agreeing to a partition would be acknowledging that. You're simply saying that this is the reality and this is what we can get. But Rav Harappa thought otherwise. And he has a letter to his son in Mikhtavei Marom, number 71, where he says, again, Kamuvan, obviously, my answer was that you can't sign something that agrees that to give up any land. Especially for Ruf Karlap, who was so tied. Yes, thank you, Rodney. The Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Ruf Karlap never left the land of Israel. He was so attached to it. Not only did he not ever leave the land of Israel, in Shir HaTayam, page 170, it tells a story how he was asked to go to Kibbutz Tirat Zvi because there was some event happening there in Tirat Zvi, and he refused to go to Kibbutz Tirat Zvi. Why? Because that was part of the holiness of the land from those people who came up from Egypt. However, Tirat Zvi, where it is, it's in the Beit Shan Valley. That's not part of the later, the Olei Bavel, the ones who came up from Bavel. There's different levels of holiness. So Rav Charlap didn't just not leave Israel. He wouldn't even go to places in Israel when these places were he thought of a lesser holiness because they were only settled by the first settlement, those who came from Egypt, not the second settlement. 1947 comes, and the United Nations votes and agrees on partition. And everyone is cheering and rejoicing. This is an unbelievable event. I mean, almost 2,000 years, Jews, I should say 2,000 years, it is 2,000 years, because Jews were not the masters of their land in the year 70. But it's really been more than 2,000 years. You have to go back to the Maccabeans, the Hasmoneans, until Jews were really masters of their own destiny with their own land. Because during the Roman era, even though you had a Jewish king, Herod, they really were not in control of their destiny. Rome was in control. So this is an unbelievable achievement. Where else in history, after 2,000 years of a nation scattered all parts of the globe, and then within the last few decades, return to a land, recreate a spoken language? When has that ever been happened? A language that died out, which is only a literary language, to recreate that, and then to be given a homeland again after 2,000 years in exile, almost 2,000 years in exile, to return where Jews once can control their destiny. I mean, this is miraculous. This is not the normal history. This is an unbelievable thing. So everyone, of course, is rejoicing over that. I would say everyone, every normal person. You have the Satmar and others who weren't, but normal people were rejoicing. Rabbi Weinberg says that the blindness of that's the word he used of the Satmar Rebbe for opposing all the other anti-Zionists changed their tune because now we once the state is declared, what are you gonna do? You're gonna oppose it? But Rav Charlap, it's a famous story. The night of partition, when everyone else is out dancing and rejoicing, Rav Charlap is crying, and the story is as follows. I mean, this is everyone in the America's world knows this story, and it's been told many times. Ritzvi Yehuda told the story as follows. It was the 29th of December, November, 1947, and the vote came in that the land would be divided. What happened? Rav Charlap comes to Ritzvi Yehuda, comes to Rav Cook's, where Ritzvi Yehuda was in Rav Cook's at this time. Rav Cook's house, Beit Rav Cook. And as Rav Tzihuda said, where could Rav Charlap go? The only place he could possibly imagine going on such a night would be there. And while everyone else is out there rejoicing, Rav Charlap and Rav Tzvi Yehuda, let me read it to you, are singing. I'm sorry, not singing, crying. Everyone else is singing. And the people downstairs hear Rav Charlap and Rav Tzvi Yehuda crying. Ritzvi Yehuda calling out. This is told by Rav Sharya Shavkoen. We heard here, Shai Yashav Cohen says, we heard Tzvi Yehuda crying out, Our Chevron, our Shechem. In other words, because the partition means that we don't have Chevron, we don't have Shechem. And Rav Charap was crying out, Yerushalayim. You know, where's our Yerushalayim? Because East Jerusalem, I mean, not East Jerusalem, Jerusalem is supposed to be an international city. The Jews are not in control of it. So they were crying. Everyone else is rejoicing, and they're crying. And then there's silence. And then they begin to sing. And as Tzvi Yehuda explained it later, that he says, we were alone together. We sat, you know, but then we recognize, you know, this too is from God. So they cried for what was lost, and then they rejoiced for what was gained. But what's significant here is that the rejoicing of Rav Charap, of the state, was also combined with crying because what was lost. Nevertheless, the rejoicing, there was a lot to rejoice about for Rav Charap. Yes, you cry over what was lost, but then after you're done crying, you go on and rejoice. And Rav Charap saw the state of Israel, as you would expect, as the beginning of the redemption. That phrase, Atchalta de Geula, which creates so much controversy, he saw it as this. When Rabbi Maimon made a Shechianu, the state, he says, let me read it to you here, Rav Yehuda Leib Maimon, who was really a super religious Zionist, when the state was declared, Rav Maimon made a Shechianu. He got up publicly with a bracha, Baruch Atah Shem Melchem Shechianu V'Kimanu V'Higyanu Lezman Hazeh. If I'm not mistaken, it says it here, I think he even, you know when he did it? I think there's a video of this. When they declared the state, if you've seen the video with Ben Gurion, the declaration of the state, I think it's at that moment that Maimon says the Shechianu. So there's a controversy there. Religious people always like to, you know, make controversy. And that people were saying, you know, it's a bracha levatala, that Rabbi Maimon, who was an enormous Talmud Chacham, by the way, that he shouldn't have said this bracha. It's taking God's name in vain. So what does Rav Charap say? Rav Charap says, if you buy a new pair of pants, you make a Shechianu. Are you going to tell me now that after 2,000 years that the Jews have a state, you don't make a Shechianu? And he too makes the bracha Shechianu. And we have eyewitness testimony that at least on one occasion, on Yom HaTzma'ut, he said Hala with a bracha. Although generally he didn't say it with the bracha. And that was, you know, the chief rabbinate did not say it with a bracha. And I don't even know if he said halal at all, because there was, in his shul, there was a dispute, it's recorded, between those who wanted to say halal and those who did not. And Rav Charap said that as a compromise, we're going to say nishmat kol chai, after davening. Rav Charap, though, would wear his strimal on Yom HaTzmaut. In Jerusalem, everyone wore a strimal from the old yeshiva. Nothing to do with being a chassid. So you see, he thought it was a bit of a yom tov because he wore a strimal. And as we saw, he thought it's absolutely forbidden to give up any part of the land. The rejoicing would soon give way to problems. We're going to have to talk in next class. You know, you still have the issue of drafting yeshiva students that he was involved in. The various wars, and then I want to, he doesn't live many more years after this, but then there's other aspects of his philosophy, how to relate to the Holocaust, other things which I want to get to. So I think we'll need probably another class, maybe class and a half, I would say, or so, some really interesting stuff coming up from Rav Yaakov Moshe Charap. I see it's 10 o'clock. Let me stop here if there's any questions or comments. I will take them now. Chaim M. tells us that Rav Zvulun Charap insisted Halbi said with a bracha on Yom HaTzmaut, and in his show in the Bronx, they always did so. Okay, so you'd have to ask him. He might tell you that that was his grandfather's view. All I know is that we have testimony that once he did it. publicly. Maybe he did it privately every other year, but his show did not do it because his show had all sorts of people in it. Following, by the way, our classes on Rav Charlap, maybe we'll get to them, the last class in two classes towards the end, but I don't think, probably not. It'll have to be next semester. It'll be Rav Aaron Cutler. That's who I'm working on now, preparing classes on Rav Aaron Cutler. But as I said, I have a lot I still want to do about Rav Charlap and his theodicy, his views of the Holocaust. So let me just wait to hear Yisrael Kashkin is typing something, and I'll wait to see what he has typing, and then say goodnight to everyone. Sometimes I see on the screen. So Yisrael says he's more of a Talmudist or a Drush type. He was a Talmudist. He wrote halachic writings, but he's not known for that. He's not known for Talmudic greatness. Of course, he's a great scholar, but not known as his writings are not studied. What's studied today are his Kabbalistic stuff, his hashkafa, his stuff like that. All rabbis who are great rabbis also have Talmudic material, but that's not what he's known for. And if he was chief rabbi, he would have had to become a posek, and he would have had to decide practical halacha questions. But he never really became that. And the rest of the class, I'm going to be talking about his ideas. And that's really why he's important, because he has a vision of our era. Wait to hear more passages from his Razi Li, it's called, the Maimar Rome, Volume 18, how he views humanity today and how he views religious leadership and his criticism of the dominant religious leadership and why Rav Kook's approach is precisely the approach that's needed today. So we'll get to that next time. I thank you all for being with us. Did he have a relationship with the Nazir? Oh, of course he had a relationship with the Nazir. The Nazir was with him in the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva. The teachers in the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva were Rav Kook, Rav Charlap, the Nazir, Rav Arieli, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda. The three closest people to Rav Kook were Rav Charlap, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and the Nazir. They were the three. In fact, stay right here. Don't go anywhere. If you want to, here's Dov Schwartz's book. It's called Etgar Matber B'chuk HaRav Kook. So that would be Challenge and Crisis in the Circle of Rav Kook. Who's on the front of it? I don't know if you can see it here. You have the Nazir. You have Rav Tzvi Yehuda and you have the Nazir, Rav Charlap, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda. That's the triumvirate of Rav Kook's followers. And each of them were unique. Each of them had their own perspective and own approach. So you can't, today the scholars, they speak in terms of, you have a lot written today about the Chug of Rav Kook, the circle of Rav Kook. And this is this book, I'm looking at it right now, rather than dealing with individual thinkers, that is Rav Charlap or the Nazir, they want to deal with them together as a chug, each with their own way. The Nazir, for instance, saw things differently than Rav Tzvi Yehuda. The Nazir had a huge background in secular philosophy, and he tries to interpret Rav Kook by using secular philosophy, Greek philosophers, German philosophers, Rav Charlap. You know, his approach is through Kabbalah, and that's how he sees Rav Kook. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he's more of a traditional Talmudist type of figure, Lithuanian type of figure, and he sees his father in a different way. So you have to put them all together. So yes, not only do they have a relationship, they were together every single day, Rav Charlap and Nazir, in Jerusalem, from the time the Nazir went to Jerusalem, in the, what year did he go? He went in 1920, I think it was. And from 1920 until the Nazir dies, until Rav Charlap dies in 1950, I forget now, was it 51 or, I'll tell you in a second. Yaakov, I forget what year we said, he dies in 51, sorry. From the time the Nazir comes to Jerusalem, until roughly in 1920, 21, I forget the exact year, maybe 22, until 1951, Rav Charop dies, the Nazir was together with Rav Charop every single day. Every day they were together. Okay, everyone, thank you all for coming. Until next week.